हरिः ॐ सहना भवतु सहना भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवसरि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण कृष्ण हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Okay, we're at the very bottom, right? According to Sri Sukadeva Goswami's account, at the beginning of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, at the end of Dwapara Yuga, Lord Brahma and the other demigods, on the request of the earth personified, approached Lord Vishnu on Svetadvipa from the shore of the Milk Ocean. One may ask why they needed to travel to Svetadvipa if Lord Vishnu is always present in Brahma's own domain. Although this journey was strictly speaking unnecessary, during some days of Brahma, the pastime of entreating Lord Krishna to descend unfolds in this way. During other days of Brahma, such as the one described in Sri Hari Vamsa, Lord Vishnu is approached on Brahmaloka itself. Srila Sanatan Goswami suggests that Brahma and the others may have gone to Svetadvipa because they felt reluctant to disturb Lord Mahapurusha's privacy while he was enjoying his sleep. Or else, Brahma may have calculated if Lord Mahapurusha were to descend to earth at his request, Brahmaloka would be bereft of his presence for the duration of the avatar. It would be better, therefore, to go to the Milk Ocean and ask Lord Vishnu there to become the avatar. These are serious considerations. In any case, when Sri Krishna descends, all the expansions of Godhead appear with him, including Lord Mahapurusha and the Lord of Svetadvipa. Thus, to say that Krishna descends through one form of Vishnu or another makes little difference. Krishna alone is the ultimate source of all avatars. Yes?
Vishnu makes another point that Bhumi approached Lord Brahma not on Brahmaloka, but on top of Mount Meru. There's no residence there.
Okay. And from there, okay. Okay, which is just the next one up. Okay. What's next?
Because if you haven't gone to Brahmaloka, you just stay there for a few seconds. Yuga's a path.
Yeah, yeah.
You go to the top of Mount Meru, 1 year here is a day there. So.
Okay, it's not so bad.
Yeah.
So these are next other serious considerations. Yes. Okay.
All the avatars being
included in Krishna. Right.
It means that when
Mahapurusha
is going to descend, it's only partially going to descend and still remain
on Brahmaloka. You can do that, or they're not there. Either way.
So he decides.
It's the Lord knows what's best for the pastime, so that he works it all out. So that therefore you get all the variety. Like you're saying here, sometimes that's the Lord on Brahmaloka, and sometimes they go to Svetadvipa. Like that. Doesn't that charge batteries?
Yes. Not right now, but later.
Oh, he's just giving that to you. You're not setting it up.
No.
I was thinking you're setting it up. Okay, great. Okay. You got some way to can charge the batteries, and then without it stopping, you can change batteries. You can.
It's
Okay.
It seems from the look of past times that he likes to occasionally disappear from the view of his devotees to increase their attachment to him.
That's there. I mean, sometimes he's there, sometimes he's not. So it's all by his will. That's the ultimate point. Is his will is what makes everything work.
Yes.
So that's always got to be taken into consideration, because we take it. There's other things, but it's his will. You know, like, why do we do what we do? You know, why do you decide what's for dinner? You know, it's by your will. There may be some constraints that, you know, all you have is potatoes. You know, but the point is you know, it's still. You know, then what you're going to do with the potatoes. You know, so with Krishna, there's technically no constraints, right? So he can do what he likes.
He likes to include us.
Yes, but we're part of the. But that's the point. Is his will is to do things with the devotees, because as we mentioned, the Ichashakti manifests the Dham, you know, the name, form, qualities, pastimes, you know, and the Dham. So. That means that's the whole purpose of it, is to interact.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
There wouldn't be something else to do. At the Lord's request, Brahma then instructed his sons to continue the sacrifices while he went to his own royal court to deliberate on the management of the universe. Right, so they're sitting there, they're doing yajñas, but then it's time to go to court. Because the general thing is yajñas are done in the morning, and then you go to court. You know, that's the standard procedure, right? Isn't that what all lawyers do that, right? They do their morning yajñas and everything, and then after that they go to the court. Yeah, so it's pretty standard. Narada praises Brahma. As Brahma sat comfortably on his universal throne, I mean, this is literally the universal throne, absorbed in hearing and reciting the glories of the Lord, tears flowed from his eight eyes. Surrounding Lord Brahma, in attendance were the personified powers of universal rulership. Narada came close, offered respects to his father by falling to the ground like a stick, then spoke. Right, the universal rulership, you know, you're talking about, let's say, you know, fortitude personified is there. It's not Indra. This is the qualities on which the universe is managed. That's who's there. You on Shastra. So Bhagavad Gita personified is there. Bhagavatam personified. Upanishads, Arthashastra personified. They're all there.
Qualities like prowess?
Yes, all these, whatever it is. His court is all qualities and scriptures. Right. Indra, then, it's the managing demigods. But that's what's unique in Brahma's court. You know, it's that it's who's there is.
It can be a little difficult to comprehend Bhagavad Gita personified or prowess personified.
Why is that?
Is it an Atma that is covered by this quality of Bhagavad Gita? How to, or is it just the guy? Knows the Gita very well. I mean, how to?
The Gita itself is a person.
Is it a post, or is it actually like Brahma is a post?
Because all these scriptures are eternal elements. So then, since you're probably not dealing with the original transcendental personalities, then they would be the potency of, you know, so then you would have, I would expect, a jiva who is empowered with that. But the thing is it's non-different from.
Yes.
You know?
It's like Shakyamuni.
Yeah, they'd be like Shaktivesh. Because everybody there is like that. So, basically, technically, everybody in the court is all personified Vedas. You know? Like that. Because everybody only thinks according to Veda and discusses Veda. They don't have any tabloids there. Or, you know, they don't have internet or... You know, they don't have to worry about all those things. Yeah, yeah, no, it's not. No, you don't have like that.
What's trending?
Huh?
What's trending on Facebook?
No, no. It's just... Because up there is that, you know, you sneeze and, you know, generations have gone by, you know, so it's... You know, Brahma went away for a moment, which means just an 11th of a second, you know, blink of an eye, and a year had passed, so... So, yeah, I don't think they worry about those things then. Yeah, because Kali Yuga is only 1/10 of all the yugas. You know, and of that, as we discussed this morning, you have, you know, 15,000 years that may be some semblance of normalcy.
But how about, let's say, the first 5,000 after the Golden Age, or the Golden Age winds down during the Golden Age, or
no? Yeah, no, it would go up and go down.
Yeah, and then it's gone.
Yeah, basically. Then devotees, you know, basically disappear. You know, the whole movement disappears. But the interesting thing is at the end, the caste system remains. You know, but it's totally mundane. But that remains, not any other, not a modern system. It's still the Vedic system remains. Yeah, which is interesting.
The Sangya at the beginning of Kali Yuga, I think it's like 36,000 years. So that's just the introductory portion.
36 so much?
It's 112. And then it must get a lot worse after that.
Because Kali Yuga is how many celestial years? Because it all adds up to 10. 12,000. No, 12 is total. It's 4, 3, 2, 1. So 1, so that means it's 100 celestial years would be the Sandhi. It's 100 on each side. But for Dwapara, then it'll be 200 on each side. Because you have the Yuga, and you have the Sandhi. You know, it's Sandhi, and then you have the other one's Sandhi, which is smaller. And that, you know, so Kali Yuga is only 100 celestial years. So that means, yeah, it'd be 1/10. Yeah, because you have at the end also. Now, is that Sunday counted within the length? No, it's not, because it's 1,000 plus 100 plus 100, so it's 1,200.
Which makes 432,000
years. Okay. Oh, so 36 is the Sunday.
Winding in.
Okay. So within that, then you have the good times. Okay. And then after that, less good. Yeah, so in other words, it's like this is how you say, being from where you are, I don't want to cause any traumatic experience or anything, or you know, things like this. But basically it's like this. When the 10,000 years is coming to the end, then the human society will be basically in the same position it was in the 60s. And then it'll go down from there. Instead of going up, it will go down.
Yep. Chant our rounds.
Yeah. So that's.
Yeah.
So that's like the bottom, and then Lord, you know, then the new mission starts up, you know, and then it'll come back down to there, but. This time, you know, it was going down, then up, down, but then it will just continue down. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, it's just another chance. Yeah.
Summer of love.
Yeah. No, they can't. They won't be able to sing the Age of Aquarius because it'll be long gone now.
Never happens.
Huh? It doesn't have, Aquarius doesn't have an age.
It never happens in the age of Aquarius.
Why, the other ages happen, but Aquarius...
Because it's talking about where the equinox moves to. According to symmetric, why it only moves so far this way, then goes back the other way, it doesn't do a full circle.
Oh, okay.
So it never gets to Aquarius, it stays at Pisces and Aries.
Oh, okay. What would be, and in, okay, Aries, what would it be in Latin? Because they could maybe use that. They probably have enough syllables they could keep the song.
Aries.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Okay. In other words, these are not topics that they have to discuss in Brahma's court, right? Okay. Narada praises Brahma, 44-54. As Brahma sat comfortably on his universal throne, absorbed in hearing and reciting the glories of the Lord, tears flowed from his eight eyes. Surrounding Lord Brahma in attendance were the personified powers of universal rulership. Narada came close, offered respects to his father by falling on the ground like a stick, and then spoke. Even though Brahma had just parted company with the Lord, his attention was still fixed on hearing his glories. Narada did not speak his mind to his father while the Supreme Lord was present. Either he thought it improper or he found no opportunity to say anything till after the Lord had left. Only then could Narada offer full obeisances to his father, because one is generally forbidden to bow down to anyone else in the presence of the Supreme Lord. Since Brahma is both Narada's father and his spiritual master, Narada may have bowed only his head to Brahma in front of Lord Vishnu, who bowed down with his whole body after Lord Vishnu had left. Sri Narada said, "It is you who have truly received the mercy of Lord Hari. After all, you are the master of all masters of the living beings of the universe, the grandfather of all the worlds. You alone create, maintain, and devour the 14 worlds. You forever rule the universe, and you are known as the self-born. Present in person in your assembly are the Vedas, Puranas, and other scriptures, the revealers of truth, who are born from your four mouths."
A doubt may arise.
A doubt may arise.
Why is Narada not realizing right away that, wait a minute, Brahma is bigger than me, is my dad? Wouldn't be natural to go straight to Brahma.
Okay. Well, then here would be another one. Why is... Arjuna bewildered on the battlefield? And then what's the benefit from that?
That we may understand.
Okay. Vidura, he wants to hear topics about Krishna, but is questioning where does he start. Did I say the wrong names? Vidura and Maitreya.
Yeah.
Vidura's questions are about us. I mean, if you don't want to get any benefit, then...
I'm okay.
You're cool.
Yeah, I'm cool.
Okay. Present in... it's do we understand or appreciate the glories of these devotees also? There's also that aspect. But then there's the glories are there, but then there's something more. Okay. Present in person, your assembly, the Vedas, Puranas, and other scriptures, the revealers of truth who are born from your mouths. Narada Muni insists that, just as the Vedas are dear to the Lord, how much more dear must be the speaker of the Vedas? Although the four Vedas are eternal, they enter the material world at the beginning of each day of Brahma, when one Veda appears from each of his four mouths. Brahma, though not the author of the Vedas, is Adikavi, the first authority on the Vedic knowledge in the universe. Tene Brahma Hridaya Adikaviye. It is he only who first imparted the Vedic knowledge into the heart of Brahmaji, the original living being. Your world can... Srimad Bhagavatam 111. 49. Your world can be attained only by saintly persons who faultlessly perform their prescribed social duties, free from pride and other vices, for 100 lifetimes. Brahmaloka is a far more exclusive realm than Svargaloka. This is mentioned by Lord Shiva in his instructions to the Pachetas. A person who executes his occupational duty properly for 100 births becomes qualified to occupy the post of Brahma. Because Indra, if you're doing 100 Ashwamedha yagyas, but you could do that in one lifetime. But here it's about perfectly following all your duties for 100 lifetimes. So that's why it said he's the most pious. The result of such a vast accumulation of piety is to become an associate of Brahma. Receiving a universe of one's own to rule is much more rare. 50. Within the universe, there is no higher world than yours. Even Lord Narayana's Vaikuntha planet is found inside your world. On Brahmaloka, Lord Narayana resides always in his manifest form as the lotus-naveled Mahapurush. He eats his shares of sacrifices and grants the sacrificial results. Although in the distant past you made many attempts and were unable to find him, after performing austerities you finally saw him just for a moment in your heart. The Supreme Lord from whose navel Brahma was born is extremely difficult to find. Brahma's having obtained the virtually unobtainable is evidence that the Lord has special regard for him. The history is described in detail in the second and third cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam. O King, the personality of Godhead, being very much pleased with Lord Brahma, because of his non-deceptive penance and bhakti yoga, presented his eternal and transcendental form before Brahma. And that is the objective goal for personifying the conditioned soul, or purifying the conditioned soul. Lord Brahma, the first spiritual master, supreme in the universe, could not trace out the source of his lotus seat. And while thinking of creating the material world, he could not understand the proper direction for such creative work, nor could he find out the process for such creation. While thus engaged in thinking in the water, Brahma heard twice from nearby two syllables joined together. One of the syllables was taken from the 16th and the other from the 21st of the Sparsha alphabets, and both joined to become the wealth of the renounced order of life. Lord Brahma underwent penances for 1,000 years by the calculation of the demigods. He heard this transcendental vibration from the sky and he accepted it as divine. Thus he controlled his mind and senses, and the penances he executed were a great lesson for the living entities. Thus he is known as the greatest of all ascetics. Srimad Bhagavatam 2:9-8. Right, so he can't tell where the lotus is from, right? Because one is he's sitting on it, and that's there. He appeared from the lotus, but that lotus being the persona, being the subtler aspect of Hiranyagarbha, right? He's the gross aspect, the subtle aspect. But where is that coming from, right? And then how does this all work? Because you're talking about the creation of everything and all that. So how does it work? How does it function? What is... Does this make sense? Lord Brahma's unique position is attested to by his being awarded initiation from the Lord, Srila Prabhupada elaborates. Thus, Brahma was initiated by the Krishna mantra, by Lord Krishna himself, and thus he became a Vaishnava, or a devotee of the Lord, before he was able to construct the huge universe. It is stated in the Brahma Samhita that Lord Brahma was initiated into the 18-letter Krishna mantra, which is generally accepted by all the devotees of Lord Krishna. One who is thus initiated in this cyclic succession is able to achieve the same result or power of creation. Chanting of this holy mantra is the only shelter of the desireless pure devotee of the Lord. Simply by such tapasya or penance, the devotee of the Lord achieves all perfections like Lord Brahma. The Lord is within every living entity as the Supersoul. and he initiated Brahma because Brahma was willing to receive the initiation. Lord can similarly initiate everyone who is inclined to have it. Srimad Bhagavatam 2.9.6-7 purport.
Are you saying
is that a Krishna mantra? Is that a mantra? Yeah, that's anybody who's has the you know the diksha in the Gaudiya line then has that mantra. Yes, that's what we're saying. Those who worship Krishna, it's a standard mantra. Like that. I'm not sure if other sampradayas, it means they'll know about it, whether they use it or not, it's another thing. Because there's so many of these mantras, it's just which ones are used by the acharyas in your particular line. That's all. Like there's Vishnu Gayatris, but we don't use them. But let's say the Shris, Madhvas, they'll use them. Like that. So the Gopal mantra is standard. Worked it out? Working it.
We've got to count the numbers and we select the sixth mantra.
Try the sixth mantra? Okay. Okay. 53. Therefore, you are surely the dearmost devotee of Lord Krishna. Indeed, you are none other than Krishna himself, appearing in various bodies for your pastimes. Right, because he is the incarnation of the mode of passion, right, which is a guna avatar, right, of the Lord. But he's a Shakyavesh avatar, like that. Sri Prick said, thus loudly praising Brahma, bowing before him with great devotion again and again, the sage Narada expansively sang Brahma's glories, as he had heard them from Indra and seen them with his own eyes. So in other words, these individuals are saying them, but he's also realizing them. Okay. That's a new one. Right, so in this it's not that these glories are real, you know, like that. Does that make sense? Yeah. To summarize, Lord Brahma is praiseworthy for his unrivaled power, for his and his associates' religiosity, and his ancient relationship with the Lord. Brahma will address these claims next, right? So they're all bona fide, but the point is this. The devotee, you know, we're looking at what we see. And the devotee always speaks according to how he feels, how he sees it. Right? You know, it's like saying, you're always with the Lord. And then Indra will say, I'm only with the Lord because the Lord is there to please my parents. You know, like that. Not actually for me. Right? And because his guru is recommending. So, For the pleasure of Guru and the Prajapatis, that's why he's there. And then he happens to be getting that benefit. But it's not that... So yes, definitely there's mercy, but it's not that he has the greatest mercy because it's not there because of him. You know what I'm saying? So he'll looking like that. So that maintains the humility. You know, it's just like you sit around and go, yes, I'm... You know, as brilliant as the sun, and all these kinds of things like that. You know. I say, I am a liberated soul. I have a position within the cosmic creation.
This is cosmic.
Aren't these the recommended discussions?
Maybe in some circles.
Yeah. So, you know what I'm saying? So that's not, you know. We're even though all that is there, we're idiots. We're here in the material world, right?
You know,
so like that.
Yeah.
Lord Brahma refutes Narada's praise, 55-79. 55. Merely by hearing what Narada said, Brahma grew disturbed. He anxiously covered his eight ears and said over and over again, "I am just a servant." With some effort, the four-headed Brahma checked the anger stirred within him by hearing what no one should hear. Okay, and rebuked his son Narada. Okay, I get it. It's American. Yeah. British, you'd put a comma there. Then you get an idea that there's some stoppage here. But you don't really need it, you know.
No.
And he's just like,
I mean, we're just being practical.
Yeah, you know, like you don't really need the back seat, you know. It's like, get rid of that, you know. You don't need the doors, you know. There's a lot of things you don't need. Yeah. So you're wondering how he covered all his ears. I'm sure if he has four heads, he probably can have four arms if he wants. See, the demigods have all these different. He has eight. Is that what he said? Four. Yeah, four. That's standard. I know. Like when he's riding on the swan, he's got four arms, right? When it comes to the passing, he's got four arms.
I still don't have only half the ears.
It's only half the ears? Well, you put the elbow in one and the hand on the other. You know. But the point is, demigods can manifest however many arms they want, right? You know, so. Like Durga comes out with 1,000, you know, like the, you know, it's whatever fits the situation.
So.
Just curious on how he does that. Means if he has this unrivaled power, there's a good chance that he can somehow or another work out how to cover his ears. Either that or he's very quick with his earplugs.
He managed to manifest everyone else's ears. And arms and everything.
Yeah, definitely he could probably work out enough arms to cover all his ears, you know. Mm. Unless he puts a thumb in one ear and a finger in the other ear. You know. Yeah, so it could just do, yeah. So you just, you know, he'll work it out, don't worry. You don't have to stay awake at night wondering how did he do it. Okay. Having to work with the material mode of passion, Lord Brahma is sometimes briefly affected by anger. Here, because his son praised him inaptly as the independent Supreme Lord, he almost lost his temper. This trait of Brahma's is also highlighted in the 10th canto, when Bhrigu Muni is deputed to find out who amongst the three chief lords, Brahma, Vishnu, or Shiva, is the greatest. First, Bhrigu went to his father's court to test how well Lord Brahma was situated in the mode of goodness. Bhrigu failed to bow down to him or glorify him with prayers. The Lord became angry at him, inflamed into fury by his own passion. Though anger towards his son was now rising within his heart, Lord Brahma was able to subdue it by applying his intelligence, in the same way that fire is extinguished by its own product, water. Right? Because from the fire is coming water. Right? So then you could subdue. You know, which is better, that one or the other? Oh, we have both. Okay. Yeah. That something's not being performed properly, since he's the one to see that everything is done in a proper fashion, like as he's supposed to, you know, see to the management of the universe. So it's not, you know, in that situation, then it's felt it's not working correctly. You know. Srila Prabhupada comments. Lord Brahma is sometimes affected by his contact with the mode of passion. But because he is Adikavi, the firstborn and foremost of the learned scholars in the universe, when anger begins to disturb his mind, he can control it by means of discriminating self-examination. In this instance, he reminded himself that Bhrigu was his son. Thus, in this verse, Sukadeva Goswami draws the analogy that Brahma's own expansion, his sun, served to put out his anger, just as water, which originally evolved from elemental fire, in the primeval creation, puts out a fire. Yes.
In the instance when Lord Shiva appeared, Lord Brahma was angry.
But he's trying to control.
He controlled it.
He's controlled it, but then Shiva appeared from that. Yeah, because from passion, then the general next stage is ignorance. But here is
it's still a prophet.
The 1089. That's true. Oh, it could be from the Krishna book, yeah. But this is going back to the yeah, we'll have to ask him how is he using it. Sri Brahma said, I am not the Supreme Lord Krishna. And what authority and by what logic do you say this? Haven't I constantly taught you about this since you were a little boy? His personal energy, Mahamaya, stands within his sight like a maidservant. It is she who deploys her material modes to create, maintain, and demolish the world. By the power of Rajaguna, Mahamaya creates. By Sattvaguna, she maintains. And by Tamaguna, she destroys. These are her potencies, and she is their controller. 59. All of us are subject to her and bewildered, so you should not think me the recipient, even a trace of Krishna's mercy. Because he's just saying, I'm training under the mode, so then it's not even like saying, it's not as you say. You know, of course, but it's not really that much. But here Brahma is saying, he's not even a trace of, so he's even more humble. Yes.
So it says that Maya is creating, maintaining, and destroying. What's the relationship to the guna avatars?
Means it's her potency is behind, and then they may have an office that they take care of certain things. Because if Maya just does everything, what does everybody else do? So that's what happens here. People have positions. There's friends, there's relatives, there's family members, there's... So those are posts.
Can you say she delegates?
Meaning?
Meaning who's in charge?
Krishna's in charge. And then she is the one who then executes that, but then that's done through all these different other individuals. Like means the whole astrological position, that's, you can say, is okay, because this planet's here, it's that. That means that aspect of it's coming through that planet. You have a different combination of modes, it comes through different planets. So that whatever you're supposed to get, the planets are. You know what I'm saying? The weather is giving, your body, and all these different things are there. So it's just, she is the one that's in control of the whole thing. Then everybody has their office that they take care of. And then there's just the common person who, just goes through life. Is that...
Could be, specifically, she creates, she maintains, and she destroys through the modes, rather than just whimsically, she just, does something fancifully.
No. She means modes are what she used. She knows what to do. That's why it said separated, energy. It's that she knows what the Lord wants done, so she gets it done. Right? But when the Lord comes in and performs his pastimes, then that he's working not under the modes. He's working independent because he's working under his internal potency. So then the modes of nature will be arranging situations and helping there, for all those who, that's what they require.
But otherwise, what's connected with him and his pure devotees, that's all the internal potency. Because Mahamaya is simply another office of Yogamaya.
So Lord Shiva, is he dealing with Krishna through Yogamaya?
Is he dealing with Krishna through Yogamaya? Meaning?
Meaning he's not in Maya. I mean, he's not in Mahamaya, right?
Right.
So he's dealing through Yogamaya.
Yes, because he's a transformation of the Lord. Yeah.
So then Lord Brahma, he's on the other side.
Yes.
So he would be dealing
Because he's through, a jiva.
Yeah, so he would be dealing through Mahamaya.
Means managing the universe is done in connection with Mahamaya. But his devotion, and that's the yoga mind.
But the whole arrangement.
Yeah, because it's that's whatever we're dealing with, that's who we're dealing with. Does that make sense? All the external situations that we put together, that's all Mahamaya. Is that right? All of us means Brahma, his sons, and their descendants. Or in other words, everyone born into the material existence. You are also one of us, bewildered souls, Brahma here implies. And so you are speaking erroneously like this. 60 to 62. By the power of Krishna's Maya, I am always deluded by various conceits. I think myself the controller, grandfather, and spiritual master of the universe. Proud of my birth from Krishna's lotus navel, I think myself a great ascetic, his great worshipper. I am overwhelmed by the countless duties of a universal management, worrying about the imminent destruction of my planet. I live in terror of the all-devouring end of time. Right? Because when his, you know, when it comes time, you know, that's it. You know, because he sees everybody else is being destroyed.
Yeah.
But then that technically would remind him of that he also will be destroyed. All I want for myself is liberation. Lord Brahma is profiled here as one of the topmost devotees in the universe. So his own self-criticism is highly instructive to sadhakas. Significant in this group of verses is Brahma's admission that, although dutifully attending to the obligatory affairs of the universe, he is overwhelmed with fear over his own impending death. All I want for myself is liberation. Bhito muktim param vrine. Footnote 27. The acharyas, however, warn us against pigeonholing Brahma into any one category. You know, the same thing in any of these devotees we've come across, because they're all devotees. Like that. So what to learn here is what it is, how we would look at our positions in devotional service. In this regard, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has pointed out that there are three categories within the status of Brahma, namely those of Karmi, Jnani, and Devotee. A Brahma who is the most exalted Karmi of the universe will have to come back to the material world. A living entity who has achieved the post of Brahma by being great a speculative philosopher within the universe may attain impersonal liberation. And a living entity who has been awarded the post of Brahma due to being a great devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead enters into the personal abode of the Lord. In the Srimad Bhagavatam 3.32.15, yet another case is described. A Brahma who is a devotee of the Lord, but who has the tendency to think himself independent or equal to the Lord, but may achieve Mahavishnu's abode at the time of annihilation. But when creation begins again, he has to return again. He has to return and again take the post of Brahma. Right? So instead of being merged into Mahavishnu like all the other living entities, he just stays in Mahavishnu's abode and spends his time there. Just like when the lower planets are being destroyed in the end of the day of Brahma, then all the sages and great personalities, they go up to Brahma's loka and sleep there. Right? But then when the creation is again, then they all come back down. So the same is that when the universe is destroyed,
that kind of Brahma then goes to Mahavishnu's place and then spends his time there with him, and then the next creation, then he comes back again. Or on the bottom, okay. I was trying to figure out where's that got to do with it. Okay. The word used in this case is beta drishtya, which refers to the tendency to think oneself independently powerful. The various destinations possible for such an exalted living entity as the Lord Brahma definitely prove that any material position is worthless for guaranteeing an eternal life of bliss and knowledge. Srimad Bhagavatam 11.3.12 purport. That make sense? So in other words, you can get the effect of karma, of jnana, of bhakti, or of mixed bhakti. Right? So any of these is what you can get. So the point being made is, whatever situation you're in, that's not going to guarantee bhakti. So only pure devotion, that will guarantee an eternal situation. Anything else, then there's always a chance of something else. Okay, so where were we about Ramana and Devai? Okay. This position is elaborated on in the Chaitanya Charitamrita during the talk between Ramana and Devai and Lord Chaitanya. Ramana and Devai then replied, "Devotional service mixed with empiric knowledge is the essence of perfection." C.C. Madhyalila 8.64. Srila Prabhupada comments, "Devotional service mixed with non-Vedic speculative knowledge is certainly not pure devotional service. Therefore, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, in his Anubhashya, preaches that self-realization following the execution of ritualistic ceremonies is in the neutral stage between liberation and conditioned life. It is a place beyond this material world, in the river Viraja, where the three modes of material nature are subdued or neutralized in the unmanifested state. However, the spiritual world is a manifestation of spiritual energy and is known as Vaikuntha Loka, the place where there is no anxiety. The material world known as Brahmananda is the creation of external energy. Between the two creations, the material creation and the spiritual creation, is a river known as Viraja, as well as a place known as Brahmaloka. Viraja Nadi and Brahmaloka are shelters for living entities disgusted with material life and inclined to impersonal existence by way of denying material variegatedness. Since these places are not situated in the Vaikuntha Lokas or the spiritual world, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu claims them to be external. In the Brahmaloka and Viraja Nadi, one cannot conceive of the Vaikuntha Lokas. Brahma and Viraja Nadi are also attained after difficult austerities. But in these realms, there is no understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and His transcendental loving service. Without such spiritual knowledge, simple detachment from material conditions is but another side of material existence. From the spiritual point of view, it is all external." C.C. Madhyalila 8.64 purport. So it's the essence of perfection, right? Means devotional service mixed with empiric knowledge. But perfection means liberation, right? When the term perfection is used, that generally means either you're saying that as a goal that they attain spirit, that platform, or it means that someone's on the liberated platform. Like you say, a perfect devotee means he's liberated from the material world. But because, you know, so you're indicating the aspect that he's not part of this world, right? And so he's part of the other, right? But here, this, because it's devotional stuff mixed with empiric knowledge, then that aspect of perfection is not going to actually, right? So we'll see when Gopa Kumar goes up through these things, then he'll come to that platform of Brahmaloka. Right.
Because that can also, yeah, means this aspect that is there. Yeah.
In Bhagavad Gita 4.10, Srila Prabhupada describes the three stages of attachment to the material world. Negligence of spiritual life, raga, fear of a spiritual personal identity, bhaya, and the conception of void that arises from frustration in life, krodha. When devotion to Krishna becomes mixed with jnana, the desire to be situated as a loving service of the Lord becomes overshadowed by the desire for liberation. While Brahma clearly enjoys a personal relationship with Vishnu and recognizes the supremacy of his form, he nonetheless laments in this and the next few verses of falling short of the standard of pure devotional service. Compared to Indra, Brahma's position is secure. That is not to say he has nothing to fear, however. Okay. In the beginning of creation, Lord Brahma was attacked by two demons, Maru and Kaitava. But Krishna saved him. Therefore, Krishna is addressed as Maru Kaitava Hantri. Now again, Hiranyakashipu is trying to replace Brahma. The material world is so situated that even the position of Lord Brahma, not to speak of ordinary living entities, is sometimes in danger. Nonetheless, until the time of Hiranyakashipu, no one had tried to replace Lord Brahma. Hiranyakashipu, however, was such a great demon that he maintained this ambition. Srimad Bhagavatam 7.3.13.
Generally, they just want to replace Indra. But Hiranyakashipu, that's why he said he was the biggest, because he wants to replace Brahma. You know, Bali Mars, oh yeah, they come in and replace Indra, never Brahma. It just doesn't happen. But Hiranyakashipu, it happened.
He went there.
Yeah, just to make sure that nobody gets too comfortable.
According to Brahma, being the Lord of all creation, creatures in the universe is not a sign of Krishna's favor. On the contrary, it is a cause of great trouble. His worldly responsibilities, you say, fill him with a false pride and expose him to all kinds of anxiety. Brahma is bewildered by various kinds of abhiman, false identity. He deludes himself into thinking he is everyone's progenitor, protector, and regulator, as if he alone were the beginning, middle, and end of creation. Moreover, the fact that the personified Vedas and other scriptures attend Lord Brahma in his court does not prove that the Supreme Lord favors him. Rather, their presence means that Brahma and the other demigods are all the more bound to follow their dictates in managing the universe. However, the process of developing, because he's saying he's independent, but no, he has to follow all these personified Vedas, what they say. That has to be what's done. However, the process of elevation that they describe, Varna Dharma, Ashram Dharma, Tapasya, study of the Shruti, etc., bear fruit only by the Lord's mercy. A point Brahma himself makes in the Brahma Samhita. I worship the Supreme Lord Govinda, by whom all acts of piety and sin, knowledge of liberation, all practices to attain liberation, as well as all living beings, including Brahma, insects, and birds, are endowed with particular potencies to produce particular effects. I worship the Supreme Lord Govinda, who bestows to the red beetle and to Indra their experience of happiness and distress, as an appropriate response to their actions, and who completely destroys the karmic results for those who practice bhakti. Brahma Samhita 5.53.54.
Right, so the red beetle is only supposed to be used as an example, not, you know, as food coloring. Right? Let's see. Right, yeah.
Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains in the purport, God impartially induces the fallen souls to act in the way that is consequent on their deeds of their previous births, and to enjoy the fruition of their labors. But out of his great mercy to his devotees, he purges out by the fire of ordeal the root of all karma, namely nescience and evil desires. Karma, though without beginning, is still perishable. The karma of those who work with the hope of enjoying the fruits of their labors become everlasting and endless, and is never destroyed. karma of those who work with the hope of enjoying. Yeah, it becomes everlasting and endless and is never destroyed. It means your karma is not going to be destroyed because you're always hoping that it's actually going to give the benefit. So therefore, you keep at it. So therefore, nitya bada. Right? But the point is that by taking shelter of the Lord, then karma is destroyed. Right? Because it is temporary. The function of sannyas is also a sort of karma befitting an ashram and is not pleasant to Krishna when it aims at liberation, i.e. desire for emancipation. I.e. is, in other words? That's in other words, because viz is namely, right? Yeah, okay. 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 Is not pleasant to Krishna when it aims at liberation, in other words, desire for emancipation. They also receive fruition of their karma, and even if it be disinterested, their karma ends in atma mamata, in other words, self-pleasure, but not those who are pure devotees, always serve Krishna by gratifying his senses, forsaking all attempts of karma and jnana, and being free from all desires save that of serving Krishna. Krishna has fully destroyed the karma, its desires and nescience of those devotees. Right? Because the desire is there, but there's the nescience. Right? The, I think I'm the controller and enjoyer. Then there'll be the specifics of the desires. Right? Then there'll be the reactions to those desires. Yes. Is that make sense? So all that gets destroyed by devotional service, by Krishna. Because for the others, the reaction, but the desire remains because the ignorance is there, right? So they can never get rid of those two. So the karmis and jnanis, no matter how pious, how renounced, how much knowledge, they can never get rid of these two.
When we say the seed, is that the desire?
That's the desire, but that's based on ignorance. Because I think I'm the controller and enjoyer. Therefore, that's the general principle of weakness of heart. Yeah. Then you have the specifics that I want to control and enjoy in this way. So that's what won't go away. Now, by performance of piety, I may seemingly get rid of the reactions, but I never get rid of the desire, which is based on that ignorance. Right? Because in the spiritual world, there is no ignorance. So if I think I'm the controller and enjoyer, that's ignorance. So where does that come from? That has to come from the material concept. So I've already come under that position of conditioning before I've left the spiritual world. Right? Because in other words, if you're looking at the other side of the river, then you're technically controlled by it. Yes? You've turned away, so you're Bahir Mukh. Yeah. Even though you may still be in a spiritual form, but your consciousness is what changed, because it's not about whether you have a spiritual form or not, it's what your consciousness is. Like Ritra had the form of a demon, also Bali, Prahlad, but they're devotees. Yes.
Anartha, is that just a verb form of upadhi?
Anartha. I don't know, you have to check. Right, because anartha is unwanted, upadhi is a designation.
Yeah.
Right. So it means it's, you know, so basically, you know, it's more of what's unwanted. So the upadhi is unwanted, desires are unwanted, ignorance is unwanted. So, you know what I'm saying? Upadhi is basically a subcategory within anartha. I would think. Yes?
You were saying about devotion, that everything is given to stroke when there is a belief.
Yes.
When there is devotion in one's heart.
Yes.
What kind of mixed devotional service?
So then some gets destroyed, some doesn't. Right? In other words, where the pure elements of pure devotion are, that's where it's destroyed. The places where it's not, that's where it's not.
the devotion will slowly overcome those fixed parts?
If that's what you want, yes. You know, if you're only, in other words, if you're only practicing devotion to get a certain material result, then it will only go up to that point to stop. You know, it's just like, like it was mentioned, karma and jnana can't function without bhakti. The results are side things given by bhakti. But as soon as they've given those results, then the bhakti goes away. Right? Because as soon as the materialist gets what they want, they're not standing in the temple offering prayers and that anymore. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's like the parent is going to the temple praying for the child, you know, for their health and, you know, their recovery in the hospital. But as soon as the child's out of the hospital, then there's a good chance they don't go back, or they'll go back to say thank you, and then that's it. You won't see them at the temple anymore. Right? So that means is that the element of karma then is supported by bhakti. Right? Because without bhakti, they can't function. So that's how it works. So if you want pure devotion, then the process will continue. But if you don't, then you'll get distracted.
So good to be studying this.
It's always good. Because that's coming up. Vidura's point is, I've heard all the histories and everything else that deal with the material energy, and giving all kinds of interesting, you know, tidbits for those who want to hear all that. But having heard all that, I only want to hear about, you know, what's directly connected to the Lord in pure devotion. So he's saying, now you please describe all these things, but now connected to the Lord. Because he's heard all these Puranic elements of creation and all those things. But now he wants to hear just directly connected to the Lord. Right? You know, then he'll be satiated. You know, that he's, how you say, then there's he's satisfied in that now it's connected to the Lord, right? That you can go on hearing again and again. But these other ones he doesn't want to hear anymore because he's heard that enough.
So that means it's tainted with some kind of material element.
Well, the presentation is such, like we were saying, the Mahabharata is presented from that angle of wanting to know all the, you know, the little details and, you know, who did this and who did that and who's connected to who and all that kind of thing. But which is fine if that's connected to the Lord. But it's not necessarily at that point. Eventually everything becomes connected. But there's a lot of extra discussions before getting there. So now the Mahabharata is such that all those things are discussed, which are interesting, and at the same time it connects it to the Lord. But the point is you can get distracted by the interesting points.
It seems that the Mahabharata is good for preaching because these are the points that devotees are often dealing with.
That, and it's also, it's just the devotees like to hear it because that's just, you know, we're dealing in the whole social, like, you know, this, you know, so much, how you say, clamor about, you know, social development and community development. Therefore, the Mahabharata addresses that. But because the Pandavas are there, then you see where it connects up to Krishna. But depending upon which, you know, volume you're using, then you can have a lot of stories in between. You know what I'm saying? Because it's 75,000 verses of stories that are not connected and 25,000 that have a connection. The 75 are connected to the 25 and then those are connected. So the point is you can function without those 75. But that's what we see in Bhagavatam. The first canto, that's dealing with the 25 without the 75. Does that make sense? So it's a whole different flavor. So like that, he wants to hear all these aspects of Puranas, you know, how the Lord creates, how he does all these things, without all the, you know, in other words, the, yeah, just how to properly connect it, how it's why the Lord's doing all these things. Right? So it's the same topic, different perspective. So that's what's important. Yes?
Now, can we say that it is a logical approach first to hear about not devotional, we can say?
No. It means it's devotional, but it has all these other trappings along with it.
But it seems that when a devotee like Bhagavad Gita, he has realization, he wants to
hear
about now the essence.
Yes.
But it means that he has already heard about Asatapa.
Yes.
So can we say that it is a normal procedure to hear about
It's a tendency, but it's not actually important. You know what I'm saying? You know, because he's in the court all the time, he's all that, so he's going to be hearing all these.
Yes.
Right? But it's not essential.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? It's not essential but if you're hearing, they're nice, because the thing is, for us, because of the Bhagavatam, we know what the essence is. So then we're going to hear Mahabharata or the Puranas and then view it from that perspective of its connection with the Lord.
Yes.
So then that's not a problem. So that's what Vidura is asking about. Right? So then that's there. But we have, you know, the there's enough here. You know what I'm saying? So one can do that, but yes, it means if you want to take it from a different angle, okay? You know, short and sweet here. Well, short, not so sweet. Better if you need to hear all varieties of things, you're reading Mahabharata and the Puranas, then you're on Facebook. Okay? You know what I'm saying? Facebook that's about the Lord, fine, but Facebook that is gossip, then, you know, better you're hearing, you know, something from scriptural gossip. But, you know, because at least then there's the connection to scripture and the culture and the standards and all that. So, because the other one, it doesn't even, that's the thing, the Puranic element, it's giving all these things, but they're connected, it's aparavidya, it's connected to scripture. And that scripture can be connected to the transcendence. But the modern context, what's the connection? How do you connect it? How is that done? So that would be a difficulty. Does that make sense? But that's only there according to our taste. You know, there's more taste, then naturally we'll find something. You know, so. But otherwise, if not, then we can stick to these. So it's not that one should go through those. That's why I'm avoiding that aspect. No, it means you start with this, and then you'll find your other stuff anyway. Right? You know. You perfectly arrange everything in the house or in the classroom. But the kids always find some way to, you know, mess it up. You know, it's like that. It's just that they know how to do it. So you don't have to separately. So the focus is on here. The other things will happen anyway. Right? So does that make sense? You know, but due to the modes, you will find your mundanity, you know. Yeah, you know, either in the scriptures or, you know, other things, or tabloids, or, you know, wherever it works for you.
It's very individual.
It's very individual, yes.
Yeah. Actually, Prabhupada took Bhagavatam when he went to U.S. for distributing.
Yes.
Straight to Bhagavatam.
Yeah, there's no need of the others. It means whatever's important, because, see, in the Puranas, they tell the same stories. They just use different perspectives. like, you know, bringing out different facts. Most of the, generally, the Bhagavatam is the most elaborate of the stories. It gives the most volume of detail. Now and again, you'll have one here and there that might have a detail that comes out, but it's, you know, it's very few. Most of them are all covered. Like that. So it's not a lot.
Some of the Puranas are very big.
Yeah, they're very big.
So what's, you know?
Same stories. Just different perspective. You know, like I said, Krishna shoots his weapon, you know, the yawning weapon at Lord Shiva, and Shiva yawns, and because he's so tired, he leaves the battlefield, right? And the, whatever it is, the Shiva Purana, Linga Purana, Krishna shoots his weapon. It doesn't say what the weapon is, right? Because you're not lying by not saying what the weapon is. Shiva yawned and left the battlefield. So what's inferred is that this is so small time, it's not even worth my time. So therefore he left the battlefield. But it doesn't say that. A person in the mode of ignorance will think that. You understand? So that's how they tell the same pastimes. But it may be different kalpas, different this and that, because some of these, they happen every day in the, you know, in the life, you know, of every day of Brahmas, you know. So there's plenty of ones that could be used. So ones that are specific for bringing out the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, those are the ones used in the Bhagavatam.
Yes.
And others may have use different kalpas, so they have different forms of the story. Like here, Prakrit Maharaj then is sitting down at the bank of the Ganga after giving up his kingdom and hearing Srimad Bhagavatam for 7 days straight without eating or sleeping or like this. But in Mahabharata, then the same position, he builds a fortress to protect himself. You know, so like that. So that's a different kalpa. Right? So there's always going to be these pastimes happening at these particular times. But because this is Swayam Krishna, therefore it's what those stories that will bring out that aspect. So it's, Krishna has fully destroyed the karma. Okay, pure devotees always serve Krishna by gratifying his senses, forsaking all attempts of karma and jnana, and being free from all desires save that of serving Krishna. Krishna has fully destroyed the karma, its desires and nescience of those devotees. Right? That's how they're able to be on that platform. As they surrender, Krishna reciprocates. So then, it is a great wonder that Krishna, being impartial, is fully partial to his devotees. Brahma Samhita 5.54 Purport 63. For this purpose of liberation, I engage others in worshipping the Lord and also worship him myself. Okay. Footnote 28. This is one of the qualities which Hiranyakashipu praises before asking Brahma for benedictions. My dear Lord, by your form as the Vedas personified, and through knowledge relating to the activities of all the yagyic Brahmins, you spread the Vedic ritualistic ceremonies of the seven kinds of sacrifices headed by Agni Shtoma. Indeed, you inspire the yagyic Brahmins to perform the rituals mentioned in the three Vedas. Being the Supreme Soul, the Super Soul of all living entities. You are beginningless, endless, and omniscient, beyond the limits of time and space. Since he is the Lord of the universe, is there any place where he is not? He does not reside. Here Brahma's philosophy defeats the suggestion that the living entity, that living in close proximity to the Lord is a sign of mercy.
In effect, Brahma is saying, I worship the Lord for liberation, not from the sheer joy of devotional service. So you should not regard this worship as a sign of my being favored. You said that God resides on my planet, but that is nothing exceptional, since the Lord of the universe lives inside and outside of everything. Right? So he's using a different thing. Yeah. He's saying, well, he lives everywhere anyway, so why are you making it so special that he lives on my planet? Right? He's living in your heart, everybody's heart, he's living in every atom, between every atom, so he's everywhere, so why is it that you're, why are you making that as the exceptional thing? Hence, Brahma asserts that neither constant union with the Lord nor showy sacrifices are symptomatic of divine favor. 64. He accepts sacrificial offerings from me only to promote the Vedic teachings and show special favor to the sacrifices themselves, which are dear to him because he is their original creator. Right? So he's saying to maintain that in the universe and encourage, then he's accepting. Right? But it's not that he's specifically showing favor to Brahma. That's Brahma's point.
How can he say that? On what ground Brahma can say that? He doesn't do it as a special favor.
He'll always look at it that I'm nothing special. Right? So it's just that as you surrender, he reciprocates. So you're offering sacrifice, which is dear to him because he's the origin of sacrifice. Someone doing it, so he's encouraging that element. So we're offering sacrifice according to scripture rules like that that's appropriate, and he's accepting that because we're offering, he's accepting. But Brahma's making the point that it's not because I'm special that's why he's accepting it, what Narad Muni is saying. Right? But we know from that side, right, that it's because of his devotional service and all that, the Lord is living with him. But at the same time, you can't have this other aspect. Because here, we know our Brahma is a devotee. But the Brahma could be a Karmakandi. He's just the best Karmakandi. Right? Or the best Jnani. So in that case, it would be like he's saying here. Because it's not a matter of devotion. Right, you've performed the piety. He's reciprocating with that. You're the most pious. You get the most attention. So he's just looking at himself as basically he's only interested in liberation. So he's putting himself in the category like a Brahma purpose or his goal is liberation. Right? Does that make sense? So putting himself in that category. Right, because it would be hard for others to call him a karmi, the way he's doing everything. So he's taking that line, and then from that he's saying that no, I'm not, so special.
His grandma is a devotee.
Yes, our Mrs. I mean, from what you get the idea, it doesn't necessarily say what universe, or when. So. When he mentions four heads, so it has to be at least the Brahma in the smallest universe, right? Because he has four heads.
Yeah.
Watch out. Yeah. So, in other words, you have to be able to balance the elements of that these are the mercy of the Lord, and they actually are mercy of the Lord because that's what the scripture says. And so it's been mentioned by, Indra in this case, and Narad Muni has appreciated that by his own, application, his contemplation, he's realized that, he's able to see that mercy. Right? But at the same time, Brahma being in the position, he's saying that I'm not actually because there's these elements. So in that you see is that the Lord's reciprocating. He's everywhere, he's reciprocating. So all it is they're using the different aspects of the philosophy to deflect from one into another. Right? Does that make sense? So it's kind of like he's using chala. Right? That he's shifting from one definition of that particular into another definition. Though both are bona fide. But you use one for, inspiring in devotional service. You use the other for making sure you're not doing something, getting distracted in devotional service. So the devotee dealing with another devotee is going to use the inspiring aspect, but the devotee themselves will use the part which is to avoid being distracted. Does that make sense? So we learn both sides of the same thing. Okay, that's why it said in the beginning that we shouldn't then from this element try to stick Brahma into, you know, a category that, well, actually is not that great of a devotee. Right? Does that make sense? All it is as a great devotee, he's pointing out that his position is not that special. So,
these are the two qualities of giving respects to others, the Lord, by the devotees.
Yeah, you could say like that. That's a very nice way of looking at it. Yes, I would say that's good. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, so therefore, Narad Muni is looking at the giving respects to others, and then who he's approaching is looking at not looking for any respect for oneself. So therefore, then you're going to have both these ideas. So we're inspired to do the service, and we're inspired in other service because of the glory of it. Right? But we're careful in our own position to see that we're not distracted by weaknesses that could come up with the element of mixed devotional service. Does that make sense? So that way we're seeing both aspects. Right? And therefore then there's more for us to learn. Because if they didn't go through these stages, they just started off with, you know, the gopis and Radharani, there's not necessarily a lot we'll be able to glean from there, you know. Then the question, so are we supposed to put our makeup on properly or not? Because the gopis didn't, but at the same time you're trying to please Krishna, so should we put on our makeup properly or not? So you want to avoid that kind of stuff.
Does the top cloth have to go underwater?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so is that regular? But what about variety? Because there's variety, so then...
The gopis don't shave their face, so does that mean I should also not shave my face?
That's also a point, yes, yes, yes. Yes.
Sakibiki's in there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Indra earlier lamented that his relationship with the Lord felt somewhat impersonal. The Lord instructed him to worship Brahma or Shiva in his absence, for they were non-different. Brahma insists that his relationship with the Lord is no different. It is mostly based on formality, as if Brahma were a governor dealing with a senior statesman. Brahma insists that he manages but one universe among countless billions, and that the Lord interacts with him in the same way he deals with all the rest. So it's not that he's pointing out, it's not specific, it's just how the Lord deals with the Brahma of the universe. That's he's point. In other words, the Lord being equal, then he's going to deal with them all the same. But at the same time, is depending upon their mood of surrender, there'll be that particular uniqueness. But he's not bringing that point out. He's just bringing out the point that he's going to deal with, so in every universe, the Mahapurusha is going to live on the planet of Brahma. Right?
Okay. So he's presenting it as if the Lord is dealing with the post-Brahma rather than the person.
Yes, yes. So he's just putting out, I'm just in the post. While Narad Muni is looking at it as the individual. Like that. So that's always like that. In other words, Brahma opines that the Lord accepts his offerings in order to honor the universal principle of sacrifice, not because he is particularly interested in Brahma, meaning this Brahma.
Because he's saying, well, you know, because I'm doing the sacrifices for liberation, so therefore, what's going to be of interest to the Lord anyway? Because he's only interested in devotion. So, therefore, it must be because he's honoring the universal principle of sacrifice, because that if that's there, then other Brahmins throughout the universe are going to perform sacrifice and in this way make their attempt to please the Lord. Right? But then again comes back to pleasing the Lord, but he's only bringing out the side that relates to that he's not a one to be respected. Right? He doesn't take the argument far enough to, you know, establish the principle of the because then it would say, yes, see, so therefore you are, you know, so you only take the argument so far, yes. Right, yeah. Well, he said his point, and now he's hearing what his father has to say about it. Okay. Let us try something here. Okay. We'll start, okay? Ready for the experiment? Okay, here we go. Then what are we? 5 minutes after, okay? And 30 seconds. Sri Brahma said, I am not the Supreme Lord Krishna. On what authority and by what logic do you say this? Haven't I constantly taught you about this since you were a little boy? His personal energy, Mahamaya, stands within his sight like a maidservant. It is she who enjoys her material, deploys her material modes to create, maintain, and demolish this world. All of us are subject to her and bewildered. So you should not think me the recipient of even a trace of Krishna's mercy. By the power of Krishna's maya, I am always deluded by various conceits. I think myself the controller, grandfather, and spiritual master of the universe. Proud of my birth from Krishna's lotus navel, I think myself a great ascetic, his great worshipper. I am overwhelmed by the countless duties of universal management. Worrying about the imminent destruction of my planet, I live in terror of the all-devouring end of time. All I want for myself is liberation. For this purpose of liberation, I engage others in worshiping the Lord and also worship him myself. Since he is the Lord of the universe, is there any place where he does not reside? He accepts sacrificial offerings from me only to promote the Vedic teachings and show special favor to the sacrifices themselves, which are dear to him because he is their original creator. Okay, that was 1 minute and 20 seconds. So would you call that a monologue? Right? It means we've been having these one-page, one-and-a-half-page purports, so therefore it seems like a long dialogue. Right? We've been going on for, you know, in other words, with the purports and that, we've been going for an hour and a half, but actually to read them on their own, it's an hour and 20, a minute and 20 seconds. Right? Okay? So, yeah. Okay. Okay. The Vedic sacrifices are dear to the Supreme Lord because they benefit all living beings by engaging them indirectly in his service. Right? Plus, Brahma is not happy, so he's definitely not going to leave much space either. This is shown in Bhagavad Gita's third chapter, Karma Yoga. In the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures sent forth generations of men and demigods along with sacrifices for Vishnu and blessed them by saying, be thou happy by this yajna, because its performance will bestow upon you everything desirable for living happily and achieving liberation. Bhagavad Gita 3.10. All living bodies subsist on food grains which are produced from rains. Rains are produced by performance of yajna, and yajna is born of prescribed duties. Regulated activities are prescribed in the Vedas, and the Vedas are directly manifest from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Consequently, the all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. Right? So everybody
lives on grains. Grains come from rain. Rain comes from the performance of yajna. Yajna is coming from, prescribed duties. Prescribed duties are given in the Veda. The Veda comes from the Lord. Therefore, the Lord is always situated in sacrifice, in yajna. Right? So this is Brahma's point, is that therefore that's what he's respecting. Because it's his system that through the performance of sacrifice gradually come up through by recognizing the supremacy of something in the universe, you know, that's authorized by scripture, gradually come to the point of the Supreme Lord. Going through karma, jnana, coming to bhakti. Right? So but coming to bhakti is still being mixed with karma or jnana. But eventually then it comes by the Lord's grace to platform of pure devotion. Right? So at that point, then that's where, you know, but he's just pointing out this side of it. Right? He's not. Right? So Brahma is quick to point out, however, that the distance in their relationship is not the fault of the Lord's, but due to his own offensive nature. Right? Because, in other words, he's respecting the sacrifice. If the relationship's close or not, that's dependent upon how the living entity interacts with the Lord. So he's saying, because I'm not interacting on that topmost platform, therefore it's not the Lord's fault, because he can only reciprocate what I offer, right? Because you want to make sure in showing that you're not special, you don't also make that everybody else in the creation and the Lord himself is not special either.
It's a tightrope.
Yes, you have to be careful. Okay, so we'll stop here.